One. Good day. We have today the distinct pleasure of having Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski with us on the line from Washington, D.C. Zbigniew Brzezinski is an eminent scholar, geopolitician, and geostrategist. He, of course, was the national security advisor to President Jimmy Carter in 1977 to 81. And, of course, he was also student here at McGill University and did his undergraduate work here, and also did his MA thesis in Russia and Soviet imperialism. So we have a great pleasure to have you on the line today, Dr. Brzezinski.
It's very nice to be back with you. It's very nice to revisit good old McGill.
Indeed. So we have an interesting beginning of the second year of Obama's tenure as presidency. He's had, of course, a very interesting year as president on the foreign front, if I may say. There's been a great deal of commentary evaluating his presidency, and one of yours, of course, which appeared in Foreign Affairs in the current issue, From Hope to Audacities, is the article as it's entitled. And you evaluate the president's performance. Could we begin with this? And before going into detail, how would you grade the president's foreign policy so far?
I would say it's a mixed grade. That is to say, he has launched the United States in a strategically as well as historically correct direction. In effect, he is reconnecting America with the world, after some 8 years during which the United States became increasingly self-isolated. In doing so, he outlined a number of specific objectives, which actually I summarize in that article in the journal Foreign Affairs. And these definitions of new goals and new postures strike me as being very much on the mark. However, when it comes to implementation, he has been handicapped by the fact that he assumed office in the midst of a very severe financial crisis, which has preoccupied him for understandable reasons for months and months on end. And he also has been deeply engaged in trying to put through a historic, revolutionary, in many respects, healthcare program for the United States. All of that deflected his attention from the goals that he outlined. And as a consequence, I think the jury is out right now. He's pointed America in the right direction, but he has not yet had any major strategic breakthroughs.
As you say, Dr. Brzezinski, he has tremendous amount on his plate domestically. There's the healthcare issue. The economic situation is not very bright. How do you see Obama coping with the tremendous challenge that we see in the news now, a possible new a front opening on the war on terror? We see Iran perhaps posturing in ways which Washington would not like to see it do so. How do you see him balancing the priorities he has at home with the foreign policy imperatives he faces now?
First of all, he has no choice. He has to address both the domestic agenda and the foreign agenda. And the foreign agenda he has to address because it will not wait for him to address it. If the foreign conditions deteriorate, if, for example, terrorism that is aimed at the United States becomes more entrenched and more widespread, the price would be enormously high. So there is a sense of urgency to the foreign policy agenda. But in addressing it, he has to be prepared to make differentiated choice. To oversimplify it, but we can discuss it more fully if you wish, in dealing with Iran, he has to be patient, because patience might still pay off. We do not know if it will, but we do know that if he's impatient, we'll have to add a crisis with Iran to the already very threatening foreign policy agenda that he confronts. Mm. On the other hand, in dealing with terrorism, he can't afford to wait. He cannot afford to be patient. He has to be very clear-cut. He has to be very pointed. And here I think he's taken the right decisions in Afghanistan, and I hope he'll follow them up with the right decisions of Yemen, which in my book means we do not plunge in militarily, the way Bush plunged militarily and then stayed in Afghanistan. We have to be much more politically sensitive, much less dominant in the response, much more pointed in our goals.
I've listened to you very, very wisely speak about patience and moving ahead slowly, but at the same time effectively to get what needs to be done, done. The question that I have to ask you is, the American people have seen 1 year of Barack Obama, and they have not seen Barack Obama live up to any of his campaign promises, whether it be to withdraw the troops from Iraq, whether it be to close Guantanamo, whether it be to downsize the Afghani conflict. Is this a sign that the governing system itself is so entrenched that change is not possible from one man?
I think, first of all, change is easier to make if it's purely on the level of definition or articulation. When you have to implement it, you have to overcome a variety of obstacles, and sometimes you often have to redefine your goals as you begin to tackle the objectively the first set of goals. You discover all of a sudden that it's much more complicated than you expected. Now, having said that, let's look at each of these issues separately. On Iran, I see no reason why he should change his views. He has advocated engagement. Engagement is a long-term process. I think people have to be intelligent enough to realize that simply saying I negotiate with someone doesn't mean that there is an instant agreement. And if there isn't an instant agreement, it doesn't mean that you abandon negotiations. Some of the most difficult issues that we have been dealing with over the years have involved painful, protracted negotiations. Secondly, on Iraq, I don't think it's fair to say that he said he would withdraw and he hasn't. In fact, I think by the end of next year, we will be out of Iraq, which is precisely what he indicated that he would do. Now, it is true that towards the end of the Bush administration itself moved towards a termination date, and that's all to the good. On Afghanistan, he has refused to escalate the war, but simply to refuse to respond to current problems, not to mention a decision to withdraw, is not a response to a war in which we have become engaged because of the President Bush's earlier decisions, from which rapid withdrawal would probably precipitate something that would be, in effect, similar to massive defeat. So here he's stuck, and he has to deal with these issues on a piecemeal basis. So I think the complexity of the challenge that we face deserves an equally complex response, and it really calls for greater public understanding. Unfortunately, the public has been conditioned to think in black and white terms, black and white contrasts. And if you don't win instantly, you're being defeated. If you don't withdraw, you're waging war for the sake of war. Things are much more complicated than that.
Do you believe that the American public has the patience to stand by the president as he continues on his plan forward?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure. And there's no doubt, for example, that when acts of terrorism or would-be terrorism occur, the public atmosphere becomes inflamed, and demagogy begins to reign supreme. Look at some of the commentaries on TV and even words on the blogosphere, even some commentaries by some American politicians. Whenever something difficult occurs, a lot of people take refuge in simplistic, demagogic formulations. And that's a real challenge in a democracy.
Dr. Brzezinski, in one of your books, which I've had the great pleasure to read, A Second Chance, Three Presidents of the Crisis and the Crisis of the American Superpower, you talk about a global Balkans, a kind of vortex which could suck the United States into a zone of perpetual instability and conflict. This global Balkan seems to extend from Egypt all the way to the western border of India, and Iran is smack in the middle. If you were currently suggesting a policy towards Iran, would you recommend further sanctions, a more severe sanction regime, or do you see Washington perhaps envisaging perhaps a military solution to the current crisis in Iran?
Or maybe neither of those two. Mm. We started negotiating with Iran roughly in October. October. That's 3 months ago. Look, the SALT negotiations and then the START negotiations with the Soviet Union lasted several years. Are we supposed to immediately plunge into a war, or short of that, into sanctions, which in effect will create intensified hostility with some possible dangers, immediately after a few weeks of negotiations? The whole idea of negotiations is based on deliberate, purposeful patience. We negotiated for several years with the Chinese before we really established a new relationship, which eventually moved into a kind of quasi-partnership. Serious negotiations on complex issues have to be tested. And I would favor at this stage widening the scope of the negotiations. We're now focused primarily on negotiating about the nuclear problem. And that's the toughest issue in our relations with Iran. But why not match that with simultaneous negotiations on regional security, where we and the Iranians have some common stake, as well as some real disagreements? And why not simultaneously negotiate also on financial and economic relationships? In such a more complex negotiating context, there is a far greater probability of some quid and quos emerging as a possible basis for a settlement. But you don't find that out if you just negotiate on one tough subject for 3 months and then say, well, if you don't agree, then you are going to be the object either of sanctions or of an attack.
Now, if I read you correctly, you do perhaps contemplate a regional solution. And yet, to put it crudely, if you look at the map, it seems Iran is sandwiched between Iraq, where there is an American military presence, and Afghanistan, which likewise seems to be a permanent American base. So it's a bit of they're caught in an uncomfortable sandwich. And now we're seeing a surge in Afghanistan that could spill over into Pakistan. How do you see this fanning out or playing out in the future?
Well, first of all, remember that in 2002, that is to say immediately after we went into Afghanistan to remove the Taliban, which we did late in 2001, the Iranians were very, very helpful. And that's just a fact of life. And the American negotiators of the time will confirm this, and some have written openly about it, like Ambassador James Dobbins, an extraordinarily able and astute diplomat. So there is a record of collaboration. Secondly, we are going to be out of Iraq next year. So we even have a self-interest in talking to the Iranians, because I don't think we want the situation there to deteriorate once we leave. And hence, it might be useful to talk about Iranian-Iraqi relations as well as our security interests. And obviously, the Iraqis have a stake in it, so do the Iranians. The Iranians have a stake in the Taliban not winning in Afghanistan, because they view the Taliban as a political as well as religious enemy. So we do have possible constructive agenda for discussions if we were willing to widen the scope of the negotiations and to display real patience in addressing these negotiations.
Dr. Brzezinski, I think you've made some very, very relevant points talking about broadening the scope of the discussions, widening the range of the discussions. Let me ask you this. 10 years after the introduction of the plan for the new American century, are the ruling elites sticking to the script, or are they able to improvise and adapt based on the current realities that you've brought up?
But what plan are you talking about?
The plan for the new American century. The,
by whom?
The neoconservative plan that was the George Bush.
Oh, well, that, I think that has been generally discredited. I mean, the whole neoconservative line of unilateralism and, in effect, a kind of quasi-American imperialism was discredited by the, well, to put it politely, inaccuracy of the claims which were made to justify a unilateral American war against Iraq. I think today the neoconservative doctrines are in tatters.
Are they simply being remarketed, or have they actually been discredited?
Well, there are still lingering sort of areas of support for it, and some politicians are still identified with it. And whenever tension rises, of course, some of that surfaces. There's no doubt that even the recent aborted, the terrorist attempt, has re-stimulated the pitching of the same line by several prominent American politicians.
Since there is an anniversary of Obama's coming to power, and yet we see that some of his rhetoric, there are some similarities to the Bush era in the sense that he invokes the need to make war in order to pursue peace. And just again on this region
Just interrupt you. I mean, the notion of having to make war in order to preserve the peace is not a Bush invention. It is basically derived from the experience of the last century. I mean, that's the experience we learned because of Munich and then the outbreak of World War II. And that's the experience we learned painfully in Korea and elsewhere, where we had to defend the status quo, lest it deteriorate into an all-out war. So there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. He didn't come to power on a pacifist ticket, and he wasn't elected by the American people to be the pacifist in residence in the White House.
Unlike Obama.
Unlike what?
Unlike Barack Obama, perhaps.
Who unlike Obama?
Whereas Obama was elected because the United States people were tired of 8 years of...
No, but wait a minute. But they weren't electing him to be the pacifist in residence in the White House. They didn't elect him in order to endorse pacifism. They elected him because they repudiated the extremism of the Bush policies. The choice is not between war or peace in favor of peace. The fact of the matter is that the global situation is inherently complex, and while war is to be avoided for as much as possible, sometimes it does become inevitable.
Now, precisely, if Obama's tactic has been changed in the sense that he is no longer going to launch perhaps a preemptive strike against a potential enemy, that would be indeed a good thing. Yet, if we may just focus quickly on this global Balkans and on Yemen, there are stirrings there of instability. You have Saudi Arabia involved. You have Iran apparently as a proxy force there. Do you see?
Wait a minute. Where, in Yemen?
Yes, sir.
What is the evidence for that?
Well, apparently the Iranians seem to be tooling with some factions of the government, or in other words, it could...
Well, be careful. First of all, there's a lot of animosity between the Shiites and the Sunnis. Secondly, Al-Qaeda is not exactly a popular organization insofar as the Iranians are concerned. So, you know, let's just stick to facts.
So the real necessity, if there is one, for a possible American intervention in Yemen would be what, in your view?
I think if there were to be, again, repetitive acts of violence against the United States emanating from Yemen, and the Yemeni authorities could not cope with it on their own, then obviously some sort of an American reaction would be necessary. And I would certainly support it, as would many other people, even though I am a strong supporter of Obama, in contrast to Bush's policies. The question is, how do you do these things, and when do you do them, and on what scale do you do them, and what else do you do at the same time to mitigate the inevitably tension-producing consequences and hostility-producing consequences of military invention? For example, in the Middle East, there's no doubt that if there was a peace between Israel and Palestine, it would help America enormously, because a great deal of Arab hostility towards the United States is political in nature, and then it is infused with religious fanaticism. I think it's in our interest to do some political things to reduce the appeal of extremism and to mitigate the tendencies towards more and more fanatically strident anti-Americanism in the region.
But can you do that at the same time as maintaining a respect for the democratic choices of the people of those states, such as in Gaza?
What democratic choices of the people have been made in Yemen?
I'm speaking about the Arab world in general, because
you can't speak about the Arab world in general. Its situations differ from country to country.
Okay, well,
I would love to see a democracy in Yemen, but I don't quite see it yet. And I don't see that it's likely on the horizon in the near future, unfortunately. If there is a threat, we have to respond to it. Otherwise, what are we supposed to say? We're not going to respond because that might somehow or other prevent the emergence eventually of a democracy. Those are the difficult choices that the president really has to make. Presidential choices are never simply black or white. Unfortunately, they have to cope with complexity by having sometimes very complex responses.
The situation is, and I know that I obviously cannot speak for the entire Arab world, but a lot of the anger from the Arab world comes from the fact that the United States has entered Iraq, has entered Afghanistan, trying to bring their form of democracy, while at the same time the United States refuses to recognize the democratic elections of the people of Gaza, refuses to recognize democratic choices made throughout the Arab world. And
I think you're perfectly correct in saying that. And this is exactly what I was talking about a few minutes ago when I said that in addition to doing what may be necessary through use of force, if the Yemeni government cannot cope with it itself, we should be pursuing also a political strategy designed to undercut the political hostility towards the United States because of some of the positions taken by the United States in the region. And I was a very outspoken opponent, for example, of the decision to attack Iraq. In the case of Afghanistan, I supported the decision to go in and wipe out al-Qaeda, although I'm publicly on the record at the time already of saying, once we have done it, we shouldn't be staying. We should be leaving.
So if we could conclude on transatlantic affairs, and one of your specializations, of course, is Russia. The President Obama has decided to reset relations with Russia. He has made some conciliatory notes by drawing the missile defense scheme in Central Europe and reconfigurating that. How do you see Russia in the long term, in the long view, responding to this? And do you see Ukraine and Georgia as potentially slipping back into their field of influence?
You know, I will put it this way. I think both Ukrainian and Georgian independence, conditions of independence, will be threatened in the short run because there is still a fair amount of momentum in Russian politics in favor of a nostalgic recreation of an imperial system. But having said that, I also anticipate that both the Ukrainians and the Georgians are sufficiently committed to their independence that they're going to stick to their guns. And I think the international community in general will support them. And the Russians are not so adventurous as to risk some sort of an all-out conflict in either case because of the unpredictable and dangerous international consequences. Nonetheless, in the short run, I think the Putin era is going to limit greatly the chances for any really profound accommodation or a wide-ranging resetting of the relationship. In the longer run, I think Russia has no choice but to eventually change its attitude, give up the imperial nostalgia, become realistic about its condition, because in fact, Russia internally is fairly weak. It is faced in the West by a very attractive Western Europe, which increasingly attracts the Ukrainians, the Georgians, the Belarusians, eventually the Russians themselves, with a better lifestyle, a better definition of the meaning of life. And in the East, the huge Russian territory, largely empty as you move eastward, is going to be increasingly confronting a much, much more powerful and wealthy China. And that places Russia in a position in which it cannot maintain a kind of separatist imperial line unilaterally sought by Russia alone. I am a short-term pessimist, a long-term optimist.
And just in conclusion, sir, Dr. Brzezinski, how do you see the future of NATO in the long terms?
I think NATO is going to continue as a major political military link between Europe and America. We need the Europeans as allies because I think we will be more responsible, more secure, and maybe even more intelligent in how we deal with the world. The Europeans need NATO, because without NATO, they would really be quite vulnerable and insecure. So that even though there may be disputes over this or that, as for example, even over Afghanistan, I think both the Europeans and the Americans realize that that connection is viable and mutually beneficial and therefore worth preserving.
Dr. Brzezinski, I have one final question for you. You've made some very, very astute comments towards the future of NATO. Maybe you could just very briefly outline your feelings towards the future of the United Nations as a body that will actually have the power maybe someday to enforce the resolutions that it passes?
I doubt that it will in your lifetime, and certainly not in my lifetime. The problem with NATO, with the UN, is that while it's an excellent organization in a number of specialized fields, food, health, development, education, culture, politically it's an organization based on the illusion that in the 190 odd states that belong to it are all equally important and equally powerful. And that illusion prevents any serious action by the United Nations.
Indeed.
Because power is not, unfortunately, evenly distributed, and power realities are fundamentally at variance with the basic assumptions on which the UN rests, namely that there is such a thing as united and sovereign and equal nations in the world.
It was a distinct delight, Dr. Brzezinski, to speak
with you. It was good to talk to both of you.
And we thank you
for
this
very much.
Global overview.